Hello, hello, guys. Okay, unfortunately, I have to create another disclaimer. We rarely have audio problems, and every now and then we will have them, and they always happen on some of the best interviews. So I have this perplexing challenge that I am having to make the decision of re-recording or recording one of these disclaimers. So guess what? Today, I'm recording a disclaimer. Today's interview is so good with Nathan and Spencer that I really didn't want to ask them, A, to re-record it, but B, when you re-record things, you know, completely different subjects come up. Some of the best content is not even there anymore. And I don't know. So I apologize for where you hear either Spencer or Nathan's voice kind of drop out. I apologize where you hear my voice drop out, but by far and large, you are going to hear one of my favorite interviews with two of the most amazing people. So, without further ado, here we go. This week's episode is brought to you by Fine Line Showroom, a West Coast wholesale rep agency with showrooms in Las Vegas and Seattle, representing over 50 fabulous gift, fashion, and home lines. You can learn more about them at finelinescompany.com. Hey there, I'm Michelle Charrier, and this is the Retail Whore Podcast, stories and lessons from a life in retail. Hello, hello, guys. Okay, I'm just going to tell you right now. I'm loving this interview so much. I will say that my love for found objects and antiques goes way back. My mom used to refinish antiques. And I think that starting with that love and then my time at Fred Segal, all of us owners, like there was four or five of us, would go to the Santa Monica flea market and like look around for amazing items for your house. And it kind of continued on as I merchandise Beautiful Mess. You know, she has amazing found objects. And now with me merchandising for Lit Concept, it's just something that's always been sort of a thread in my life, I've realized. So when I had the chance to meet Nathan and Spencer from Agora Antique Market at the Las Vegas show in January, they were lovely. They stopped me to tell me how much they love the podcast. And then Jill from Stephen Young, who's also my rep, introduced me to them. And I came back when we got finally moved and situated. I sent them an email and I was like, I would love to, actually it was a DM. I would love to interview you for the podcast. And I'm so happy they did because this story is amazing. Nathan and Spencer acquired Agora Antique Market in 2023. And I don't know if you, of all of you know this space, it is amazing. It is massive. It is a collective space where it is much like any antique market. It is all different spaces where everyone sells their own things. But I will tell you, from a cohesive standpoint, when you walk into that space, you have no idea it's multiple owners. So I cannot wait to dig in and have you guys listen to this. There's a little bit of merchandising. There's a little bit of how they run their businesses as far as being in a multi-owner situation. There is a lot of inspiration. So without further ado, here's my interview with Nathan and Spencer of Agora Antique Market. Nathan and Spencer, welcome to the Retail Whore Podcast.
Yay, thank you for having us.
I'm super excited. Okay, so there's two of you, so you have to give a little bit of voice recognition so everyone can understand. Nathan, say something so everyone understands your voice.
Hi, I'm Nathan.
And hello, everyone. I'm Spencer.
Okay, just so everyone, because I realize people will ask questions and everyone's like, who was that? I can't tell. So we try and do that in the beginning. I was so honored to meet you guys at the gift show. And when I found out who you guys were, I was like, I have to have you on the podcast. So thank you for being here. You guys are the new owners of the Agora Antique Mart.
Yes. Thank you for having us. We're fans of your podcast. We listen to it when we're in the car and want to try some merchandise here at the warehouse. And yeah, it was awesome to get to see you in Vegas. And thank you for having us on.
Oh my gosh, thank you. I've been a fan of that building forever. And you guys have a very lengthy design and retail background. And I can't wait to dig into that. But why don't you guys talk a little bit about, we're going to start with Nathan, give a little bit of background on yourself and up to when you guys met.
So I started probably in the fashion industry, like background retail merchandising for Express. At the time, they were the limited brand.
I love it.
And I did floor sets for Express Men, Bath & Body Works, Victoria's Secret. And then with that playing out, I opened up my own candle fragrance shop in my hometown. And I had over 30 different fragrances, from candles to reed diffusers, home spray, that I formulated all myself. And then transitioned into the hair industry. And that was the last 15 years of my career, was in the hairdressing world in Boston and New York.
Did you still have your retail store, or did you just say goodbye to that altogether and just went a totally different direction?
I said goodbye to that in a totally different direction.
Okay, I have to ask you why you said goodbye to retail at that point.
So it was a career change for me. So in my hometown, I finished the hours that I needed for hairdressing. And once I got my license, I closed down my candle shop.
Okay.
And I did some online selling my first year in New York, but it became too hard and too overwhelming. So it completely closed down.
Wow. Okay. It's always interesting to hear people that make the jump from like completely different industries. Like, why did you do that? So it's interesting. Like, thank you for sharing that. And then Spencer.
I started collecting antiques when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And by the time I was 12, I was going to the shows and selling antiques. So I was always just that odd child that didn't like, you know, Transformers and G.I. Joe and all of those things. And then it was a creative spirit and got into photography. And then that led to architecture school. And I had my own design firm and realized that I liked construction more than design. So I started up a design and construction firm with a specialty in historic preservation in Houston. And that was right after Hurricane Katrina. And as New Orleans was rebuilding, there was an influx of tons of architectural antiques from all the houses that had been destroyed. And so I started going to New Orleans and bringing those pieces back to Houston and using them in my projects. And after that, I decided to join the Navy. It was kind of like a midlife celebration. They have a civil engineer corps, which is engineers and architects. So it wasn't a huge stretch. So yeah, I embarked on building projects for the Navy for about 8 years. And that took me to San Diego. And the pandemic happened. I met Nathan. And right around the pandemic was when Pier 1 Imports closed down. And that's where I bought all my reed diffusers for years. And so I was like, I don't know where I'm going to get my reed diffusers anymore. And Nathan was like, well, I know how to make them. I used to have a candle shop. And I'm like, oh, interesting. And so I started telling him about how I had this background with antiques. And from there, we were like, well, let's just start a little side hustle. We can sell antiques. We can relaunch some of your most popular fragrances. And we got into a little antique shop in San Diego, and it was a hit. So then we just started replicating that. And up till about, 2022, by then we were in 4 locations, all antique mall formats. So we had the first spot was in Ocean Beach in San Diego, and then La Jolla. And then by then we were moving up to LA. And so there's the Mark Collective in Venice, which we still have a spot at, and then the Agora Antique Mart. And we were there for about a year, and it was our most successful location of the 4. And it was just like, why are we doing this Navy thing? Like, we can just live off of the success of this one booth at the Agora Antique Mart. It was an 8x10 booth, so 80 square feet, and put in my resignation from the Navy. And we were planning for this next chapter. And then that's when the owner of the Agora Antique Mart said she was retiring and was going to close the shop down. So that was our opportunity to be like, this is a great store. It's been around for 36 years now. And what can we do to keep it going for another 36 years?
Okay, there's so much to unpack there right now.
I'm trying to summarize there, like 40 years of how we got to here.
So number one, I love that you collected antiques as a little kid. There's always the weird kid that likes stuff like that. And I love that that's you, and the fact that you were actually going to flea markets and selling as a 12-year-old. That I think that beats almost every, because I used to, in the very beginning, I would ask like, how old were you when you first started working? Because what I've really realized is that the true hustlers, like all of us, have started working like at 13. I started working at 14, 12 years old. It's probably one of the youngest ones I've heard, which I love.
Yeah, I had a newsletter and edited it, mailed it out. That's where I learned a lot. I tri-fold paper.
Oh my God, that is amazing. What did you collect when you were a kid?
It's primarily glass insulators, which are those little things that go on top of telephone poles.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, there's a National Insulator Association, and there was the local chapter, and all the leaders in that collecting field lived in Houston, where I live. So they were the people that wrote all the books, and these people were in their 70s and 80s when I was 12. So I just learned what I could from them and tagged along to insulator and bottle shows and kind of learned to sell old things.
Okay, that is amazing. Okay, my other question is, because I've always seen those little things and I've seen some people make stuff out of them, but what, other than just being an object, what else, what do you do with them?
So if you're an insulator collector, you just have them on a shelf. And I think that was part of the inspiration for us recreating this idea of an antique store. So from somewhere from the early 90s to maybe 20 years later, antique stores, some of them evolved to these home decor stores. Mm-hmm. And there's probably various reasons why that happened. But while I was busy doing the corporate architecture thing, these antique stores were evolving and not just being like a thrift store where
objects are just watch it fly.
Yeah, yeah. And so you started to see these vignettes being created in some antique stores and them introducing new categories, whether it's books or greeting cards or candles. And I was oblivious to all of that happening while I was focused on college and building a career. So I was so inspired to finally see these antique stores that did vignettes like I did as a 12-year-old in my bedroom with my insulators and bottles.
You have no idea. Okay, so you followed along with the older guys and you got all this knowledge and you obviously kept that love, because then when you go into doing the construction firm and specializing in historical elements, it's funny because my mom, growing up, my mom was an antique refinisher. So I remember always in our garage, she had, and this is like, I want to say like the 70s when it was like that California oak where, and I hated that. I was like, ugh, I hate these. And it's so funny to me that now I have this love for vintage and found objects, but they're not, I still don't have this overwhelming love for that 70s oak stuff. Cause I feel like it, unless it's done in a really different finish, I feel like it's still like what I grew up with in my garage with my mom sanding everything down. But it's funny, like you meet people that have that been around this industry for so long. So when you started doing the design thing and pulling out the architectural elements from New Orleans, did you like how, because I know in order to sell that, you have to know a lot about the origin of it and the age. Like how did you study that when you're pulling it out of demo or out of basically wherever you're pulling it out of post Katrina?
Yeah. So when you go to architecture school, definitely like any field, you learn the history of that field. And so I knew a little bit about the history of architecture, but around the time that I finished architecture school, Houston was creating its first historic districts, which pisses off a lot of people. You know, when you buy a house and then suddenly it's in a historic district and you can't change it. And so I already had my design firm and people started coming to me. It's like, how do I get this approved? How do I do all of this? And so as I was learning that bureaucratic process of permitting, that's when I was finding all of these pieces in New Orleans. And thankfully, most of New Orleans is kind of a Victorian style architecture. So you don't have to know too much about the history, but it kind of started from there where it's like you have these neoclassical elements, you have the Victorian elements, and then ultimately like a craftsman bungalow type style. But other than that, it doesn't deviate too much from those styles. The other cool thing in New Orleans is, you know, you go back a couple hundred years, there were no interstates. There was no railroads to get to New Orleans. The only way was by barge up the Mississippi River.
Wow.
And so some of these architectural elements have the addresses of every house they've been on. So that was already part of the culture in Louisiana of once this building is past its prime, take what you can off of it and you reuse it in another building. So I would be bringing stained glass windows to Houston that had been in four or five different houses in New Orleans. And then, you know, our culture is fast fashion, throwaway culture. So it's just like, here's this window that's been around for a couple hundred years in four different houses and is now going to be thrown away if someone doesn't rescue it.
Salvage places. There's a salvage place, I think, in Altadena that I used to go to that I absolutely love, where you'd go and it's like everything from the enamel. I think Justina from Jungalo pulls a lot of their enamel stuff out of them because it's all like those. I mean, the enamel stuff's not as old. It's, I think it's like 60s, like the pink, like those hideous pink colors and mint green bathtubs. And, but I still remember the columns and some of the window frames and stuff like that. They're so beautiful. We're moving to Oregon and we're staying in Jacksonville. I've got this weird love of like old architecture as well. And I didn't realize like how historical downtown Jacksonville is, and like all the buildings have the year. So, like some of them are like 1850. We went through a cemetery the other day and like the store, I mean, one, a couple of them have like plaques on them as far as what happened to the family. And one family from the 1800s, the whole family was killed by Indians. And the way they found out that the family was gone, the covered wagon was going through the fields on fire. But you're reading this and you're standing there in front of these graves with these dates. And it's like, I mean, that's where history to me is just like so incredible. And considering I didn't graduate from high school, I hated history. It's amazing now that I love it. So I can't wait to find out about your spaces before Antiquegort owning this. We're all in antique malls.
All in antique malls that were a mixture of antiques and newer things. I think Mark Collective is probably the only location that was 100% vintage. Yeah. And we're kind of like the booth that is introducing like the best of the Agora Antique Mark at the Mark Collective in Venice.
I haven't been to that one. Which one were you in, La Jolla?
That was Girard Avenue Marketplace. Okay. A great little spot on the corner of Girard and, oh gosh, I forget the cross street, but right in their little downtown area. They've been there for years under several different owners.
And Nathan, were you producing the candles? Like, are you doing it? Were you doing it under your own brand and then marrying the antiques? And this is what your booth was? Were you creating the candles, correct? And the fragrances?
Yeah. I was creating the candles for our four locations at that time.
How many were you doing? Were you doing both candles and diffusers?
Yeah, so candles and re-diffusers, and it was about 14 different scents.
Okay, my first question is, how are you both doing this with three locations and production and sourcing? How are you doing this? Do you have teams? Is it just the two? Because I know a lot of antique malls, you don't need to have someone there because the person goes up to a main cash register, but like, how are you doing this, just the two of you?
So, well, right now, currently, we don't do the candle line anymore just because we don't have the time. We used to paint our furniture too. If it wasn't the 70s piece of furniture, we would paint it. We don't have a lot of time for those projects anymore. So at the shop, we have a staff of 10 people, and then we have 32 dealers that are supplying merchandise for about half the store. So it's 9,000 square feet. And we have about 4,500 square feet of that. And then the other 32 dealers are in the other half. So that's the store currently. And then before we took over, it was just the two of us. I was still full-time Navy. Granted, it was the pandemic, so you had a little bit more time.
Yeah.
But yeah, we made the candles. I had we still have a boat down in San Diego. So we would do a little bit of the candle making on the boat.
Oh my God.
A little bit of it at a townhouse that we bought during the pandemic. But yeah, I think it was just a big operation. And once we took over Agora and we saw the plethora of candle lines out there, you know, the hardest part of doing a candle line is the jar in the box.
I know.
And that's the majority of the cost. So to continue to scale that, there's a lot of risk involved. When you could just go to Voluspa or Lafco or, you know, some of these other far more well-known brands and just carry their product for the same price.
Well, I don't think people realize, because I developed the candle line for Raw Paradise for a couple years ago during the pandemic. It was like a side project for them. And I don't think people realize like how little of a markup there is in there. Like it's unless your candle is going to be, you know, $85. So when people are like, oh my God, this is so expensive, it's like, there's not a ton of markup in candles. Like it's just known that there's not. And it's, I can understand why it's like, we'll leave it to those guys and do, you know, what you guys do best is sourcing and whatnot. But so you were painting the furniture as well.
Yeah, so that was a part of, so years and years ago, I would import furniture from Europe. And so that was kind of the plan in San Diego, was to kind of bring that French and Swedish import business to San Diego. Then the pandemic happened and there was no importing at that point. And so it was just like, well, I know how to paint, to do that old world finish on furniture. You know, it's not just chalk paint, you know, it's a several layer step process. And so we started painting furniture. And that's actually how we got into the first antique wall, was that our pieces looked like a 300-year-old French antique. But then when you open the drawer, you're like, this is Drexel from 1975. Like, and it's just like, yeah, it's, you know, that honey oak finish. And it's like, yeah, that doesn't work in everyone's style. So it's like, why throw it away? You could just paint it. If it's in good shape, it's solid wood, you're not going to hurt it. And if someone doesn't like the paint finish, they'll just strip it down and do their own thing with it.
No one has that much patience. Are you kidding me? Way too ADD, way too impatient. That's why I'm not allowed to paint my house, because I'm too impatient. And it's like, I skip over a lot of steps. And I think that's the norm. I mean, there's very few people that have the patience and the tenacity of like doing it, especially when it's a multi-layered process.
Now, each piece takes us about a week. It's like one layer a day. But the secret is we don't need sandpaper. We don't own paint stripper. So it's like we save all of that prep mess that a lot of people think you have to do to successfully refinish a piece. It's like chalk paint saves the day. Paint it with chalk paint, come over it with something else, and then go on to the other steps to get the look you're going for.
Take me now to, okay, so you decide to purchase Bogor Antique Mart. Have you already closed your other locations then, or do you still have a couple of the locations?
Well, at that time, we still had all four locations. Yeah. By the time we officially took over, we had downsized to just two locations. So we had the Bogor Antique Mart and then the Mark Collective booth in Venice.
And you still have Venice.
And we still have Venice. And that's been great because we use that as a feeder to our store. So often people in West LA have never even been to Agora Hills. Like, they know about Calabasas, but you know, they're not going to make that drive unless
it's there's something. From driving there, like literally once a week for years, it's always shocking to me. People are like, where is that? Oh no, that's so far. It's like, it's really not, but okay. All right.
Well, and from when we had our four locations, there was 150 miles between all four. And, yeah. And you did that weekly. So it's like, you can do it if the money is in it. Like, obviously, if you're not having fun and not making money, then sure, that's a very painful commute.
So now with the Agora Antique Mart, like I'm excited to hear about how, because, okay, explain for the people that don't know how antique malls work, explain how they work. And yours is a little bit different, but I feel like, because yours is so much more elevated than going into... When I say stack it high and watch it fly, one of my clients is Lit Concept, and Mitchell Lit, everyone knows, has been in the industry for 40 years. He would container in things from Europe and he'd drag his sons with them. And Kevin's grown up around the industry, and you know, Mitchell would like, it was literally like 16 dressers all like stacked up to each other. And I forget the one, was it Hertz? There was one that was, in Hertz. I remember going there with my old boss from Fred Siegel and just it's like literally tiny little aisles of just stacked up antiques, like miles. And that doesn't have a lot of, you know, draw, I think, anymore. People don't shop like that now, because now everyone's cross merchandising and doing more lifestyle and doing vignettes. Explain to people what the Agora Antique Mart is like, because it's very different than your standard antique malls.
Yeah, so it's 9,000 square feet, the 30 dealers. I think the previous owner, what initially set them apart was that each booth has white walls, and we don't allow those walls to be painted. You can put up removable wallpaper, but the walls stay white. So that automatically gives it this gallery format look, where if you go into a traditional antique mall, it's very country. You know, someone may do barnwood, someone may do wallpaper, someone may paint it black or a bright color. And so it's very individualized, kind of like a flea market. So for us, all the walls stay white. We don't deviate from that. And so when people walk in, we have high ceilings, these 10-foot white walls. And most customers, if it's their first time in, they don't know that it's an antique mall.
Yeah.
They don't know that it's individual dealers. And then interspersed from that is our merchandise. And so you may go from a booth that's 100% antiques to a booth that's 100% gift items to, like, one of our newest booths is the baby booth. That was kind of a year in the planning of, like, let's introduce baby clothes. And who knew that it was going to be such a hit? Like, that was...
There's nowhere to buy great baby stuff there. I mean, I think the Seagulls have a store that's on the other side in Calabasas, but there's really not a place to buy great baby stuff there.
Yeah, it has been a huge draw for new customers coming into the shop.
What lines did you bring in for the baby department?
Well, we started with Milk Barn just because they had the book. And so that's kind of how I wanted to start with telling the story of merchandising the table. It was like, okay, we'll have a book, we'll have the outfit, and then I'll find some plush animals that kind of work with it. And so Milk Barn and Mon Ami, just for the plush animals. And Vermont Teddy Bear as well, which was one of our goals is to look beyond what's in Las Vegas, Dallas, and Atlanta. And so Vermont Teddy Bear was one of those where I just reached out to the company directly and was just like, I want to wholesale your product. I know that you're very successful online, one of the largest teddy bear companies solely online. And they were like, no, we'd be more than happy for you to carry our products in your store. So that's always our goal. It's like, let's find companies and products that don't have a huge wholesale footprint.
Yeah.
And see, sometimes they say no. We hear no a lot, but I think that, yeah, you got to ask, and that's how you're going to differentiate from your competitors. It's like, if you're all buying the exact same stuff at the gift show, the customers realize.
That brings up a really good question, because obviously, much like one of my days during Fred Siegel, it's a lot of owners under one umbrella and everybody's fighting for the best. I mean, I remember doing the gift shows and it was like this super stressful race to find the best thing. And you're like running through, because I had Darylin from Zero Minus Plus. I had the girls from Fred Siegel Fun, because I had apparel and gift. So it was like trying to find lines before anyone had it. And then, you know, I was the young new one. So if Darylin found it even after me, usually the vendor would go with Darylin. But I just, you know, with everybody being under the same roof, is it a challenge because you're dealing with 30 different, however many vendors, 30 different buyers? Is there a challenge of people having crossover with merchandise?
Yeah, we see it within our store with 30 dealers. Some of them go to those same gift shows. So we have to work through that of, you know, it's like, you'll carry this, you'll carry this. Sometimes we miss the mark and we're all unpackaging our stuff. And it's like, oh, we bought all it after the Easter. We're like three of us that all have the exact same Easter bunnies. And, you know, it happens.
Do you guys, I mean, it's because it seems like it's more of a community there. Is it more like, I mean, is it less like bitchy competitiveness and more like, oh, we got the same thing. Oh, well, we'll all sell it. Or is it, you know, because I know there is a competition thing, but it seems like it's so much more community there because you guys are there within the same walls every single day together.
I think it was more adversarial in the past, but when we took over, it was just like, we all have the same goal in mind, and it's not to carry what someone else is carrying.
Yeah.
So it's like, we try to share a little bit ahead of time. We discuss kind of like, I mean, Christmas is a big thing. We all buy our Christmas in January, and, you know, fast forward 11 months later, it's like, we don't want to be unboxing and realize we have the same things.
Yeah.
So we talk about companies that we're buying from. We talk about themes. We definitely have a color theme that we do up front that is very different than some of our other dealers. So we navigate it and we understand that it's like, for instance, the bunny rabbits. When I pulled them out and a dealer came up, was just like, I carry those bunny rabbits. I've carried those bunny rabbits for a decade. And it's just like, oh, shit. Well, thankfully, I only have three. So when those three are gone, like, it's not like I bought, you know, 100 of them.
Yeah. I always wonder, and not to put you on the spot, but it's like, it's because Fred's was the worst. I mean, it was. And now my thought on retail is, as far as competition, it's like, we're all there to support each other. You know, you may have the same thing, but it's like, honestly, like, the customer's there to experience the whole thing as a whole, whether they buy the one item from you or the one item, but it seems like there's so much for everyone to buy from. It's like, don't worry about this, like, one spoon because this person carries this spoon line. It's like, you know, don't worry about that. There's so much other stuff that, you know, so that's kind of my philosophy now and all that after living through it at Fred's.
Well, yeah. And I think we launched a jewelry line called Nathan Spencer. So it was just a new idea. We lost a jeweler. And so we were like, let's just bring in some jewelry. And lo and behold, like one of the bracelets was very similar to one of our vendors' bracelets that she carries. And it's like, we just immediately pull it. It's like, it's not, that isn't even worth it. It's like our mistake. We didn't realize it. So we just took it off the floor and no reason to have bad blood and be good.
Yeah.
And we do the same thing with some of the other shops in our center too, where we don't have that daily kind of conversing of what they're buying and stuff, but we want to be good neighbors. So if a rep tells us that Beautiful Mess has something similar or Mixed, which is another store in our strip center, has something, we stay away from it. It's like, we want to be different.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, I don't think people go into it intentionally to like buy the same thing. It's just, it's beautiful things and we all see something we love and we get, and it's like 9 times out of 10, the person that's ringing or writing you up at the show is somebody that's temp that doesn't know the account list. And it's like, you know, sorry, it's like, oops. I will say that your rep, Christy, who listens to this, I now, because I was today, I'm like, I'm so excited. I remember being the guys from Agora Antique Mart. And she's like, I love them. They are so loyal. They're so, I mean, like everybody in the industry, I will say this, absolutely adores you. So it's, you know that you are running a community that people love shopping there as well as love dealing with both of you. So I just want to tell you guys that though.
Well, thank you so much. And we love Christy too. She's the one who introduced us to the Mon Ami baby line with the plush animals.
She's a good friend. I just adore her. So now tell me how you guys split up. Okay. Well, one, I have to go back to the jewelry line that you're doing, a jewelry line. Now, are you designing and manufacturing yourself?
No, it's more of a private label, yeah. Which I think that people shouldn't, you know, poo-poo the private labels. It's just like, no. That's a way to test an idea. And, you know, low threshold investment. And so if it doesn't work out, you just move on to the next idea. But other than that, that's where we see the future of growing the business is building these smaller brands. And if they're successful, that's an opportunity to spin off that brand into its own brick and mortar store, its own website. And that's what we're looking for, resiliency, because, you know, we're in an area that there's a huge wildfire risk, obviously a huge earthquake risk. We're right next to a nightclub. So it's like there could be active shooters. There could be, you know, anything that happens, another pandemic that forces us to shut down operations. And, you know, it's like, what's the plan? And so we have all of these kind of mitigation plans to launch if we have to shut the store down so that we can keep our staff on payroll, keep paying our rent and keep making money.
Well, I love that you kind of have your hands and you keep trying different things and you have your hands in all these different things, because I think most people will get totally overwhelmed by that. I know I would, but I mean, you know, like I always use the term hustler, but you always know the hustlers where, you know, it's like, I'm going to try this and then I'm going to try this. And it's like, I love that. I think that that's, for me, it's like, it's, you take risks and the risks end up being big payoffs. And the only way you're going to know that is if you take some of these risks and try some of these things and create your own brand. And you guys are creating like this whole new experience and new brand by doing what you're doing and creating your own things.
Hi guys, I hope you're enjoying this episode. Now for a message from today's sponsor. Fine Lines Company is one of my favorite rep groups and some of my most favorite humans. If you don't know them already, Fine Lines is a West Coast wholesale rep agency with showrooms in Las Vegas and Seattle. Fine Lines represents over 50 amazing gift, fashion, and home lines. Powerhouses like Patty Wax, Scheme, Mary Mary, K Hall, Home Art, and so, so much more. You can learn more at finelinescompany.com. They also have a new division called Egg, which I'll be honest is one of my favorites, that features smaller, cool indie lines with an emphasis on West Coast based women owned lines. Egg has its own shopping site at eggishere.com. Now, back to our episode.
Yeah, and I think, you know, another good example would be the greeting cards. Before we took over, we thought that was the most ridiculous thing in the world to carry.
And
we
were just like, you know. And they make so much money.
We didn't know that at the time. All I knew was that every school that I grew up with has closed. So that obviously means that, you know, it probably wasn't making money. They'd still be in business. And so why would you carry greeting cards? It's our number one seller. So
I know.
And, you know, the price is printed on it. So it's like there's no wiggle room where I can make that more profitable other than volume. But we have customers that come in on a daily basis and buy stacks.
It is crazy to me. Serendipity is one of my accounts. And, you know, I've realized a lot of retailers do not run reports. We've had open to buy people on, and we've all talked about, like, your reports are literally your Bible. Like, get to know your reports. That's really truly what's going to show you what's running, what's selling, and doing the business for your store. And I was like, you know, we're looking at real estate I could eke out more for gifts, because she had a lot of product in floor. I'm like, well, what about cards? And she's like, well, you know, they sell. And I'm like, how much of the business do they sell? I'm like, let's look at the numbers. And she pulls it up. I'm like, holy shit, that's your number one department. It's like, okay, we're keeping the cards there. I mean, it's mind blowing. And I fought cards. I'm not going to lie. I fought cards for a long time. My pharmacies, like Burt's, I fought cards forever. And now it's like, it is like one of the top sellers. It's insane to me. I eat
And we have a line of quilling cards by Nikki D, and they're really expensive. So it's like 1/6, 8-inch card is $15. And customers will bring them up, find out the price, they go back. And everyone was just like, you shouldn't carry these expensive cards. Well, I reorder them almost weekly. And so I tell people, it's just like, I am making, you know, $7.50 off of a 6-inch space of wall. Like, I couldn't hang a painting there and make that kind of money.
Now, are you both with your own spaces? Are you still sourcing found objects? And then how are you doing? Tell me a little bit. Well, before we go into that, I want to find out first, how do you guys split your responsibilities for work? Like, what is Nathan? Because I'm assuming you do things together, but I'm assuming that you both have separate roles.
Yeah. So I think in a nutshell, we say that Nathan runs store operations and I run warehouse operations. I also do the accounting. I do the social media, all the marketing. And then Nathan really does the merchandising. So it's like, I'm creative and can do merchandising, but I'm very slow at it. And he has a natural knack for just doing it really quickly. And it looks great. So he's in charge of merchandising and pretty much the front half of the store. And then I kind of have the back half. That's where the baby booth is. That's where antique booths are. And it's, well, honestly, I told you in Vegas, like, I just copied you, your milk barn displays.
With the sheep, or did you do the one with the tent?
I did the one with the tent, and then I had some sheep that were down below. They were like sheep ottoman that I put down there. But it was just like, I had to launch that booth super fast because it was like an unexpected, we had a plan to launch it at that time. And so it was like, I didn't have time to figure things out. Like, it was just like, I'm buying this, so it's like milk bar, Mon Ami, and then it was like, how do I put it together? And I was like, I'm just going to copy Michelle.
S'mores? Did you make the s'mores out of the giant marshmallows?
No, but that's a good idea. But no, I took the tent was kind of the best thing.
The tent is the cutest thing.
There, it launched another brand that we're bringing in. So on that tent, I had a little chalkboard, and I just wrote Camp Agora on it. And customers started asking. They were like, do you have Camp Agora baby clothes? And t-shirts for adults. And now we're bringing
up Beverly Hills Camp Agora. That's fucking brilliant.
Right. So it's like those little things that it's like, okay, this is another potential moneymaker for us in a brand. And so that's going to be coming out probably this summer, that we'll have baby clothes and adult clothes that all say Camp Agora on it.
You need to send me one. I need one.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Nathan, I have to ask you about merchandising because you are the merchandiser. So when are you doing your merchandising? Do you go in early in the mornings or do you do overnights? Or are you doing it during the day?
So I would like to do it during the day, but I try to keep the floor as spotless and as presentable as it possibly can be while customers are coming in and out of the shop pretty much after close and in through the wee hours of the night, early mornings. At least every other day, 3-4 times a week. So it's...
Wow.
Yeah.
How often do you do your big... Do you do big floor flips since you have designated spaces, but do you do big floor flips? Because I know when holiday comes out, you guys do it big.
We do. So the front part of the front half of the store, which is pretty much mostly new merchandise, That usually gets flipped every quarter. And then from month to month, depending if there's a holiday, it slightly gets tweaked. But besides that, a huge like switch around of the floor set is usually every 3 to 4 months.
And the merchandising you're doing 1 and 2 and 3 times a week, is that maintenance, interjecting new merchandise? Talk to a little bit about that.
It's a little bit of both, like definitely restocking of merchandise and recurating. So if something sells or sells out, like introducing something that can create that story and not look like it's just thrown in and it messes up the story, but definitely keeping the like edits to amplify within the appearance of the shop at all times.
Okay, I need to go back to you just saying interjecting merchandise, because in making sure it looks new, I'm always telling people it's that your focal spot is the most important thing. It's the thing that everybody sees right first when they walk in the door. It's also your regular customers who may or may not be planning on coming to your store. Walk by, look in. If your focal section does not change, it looks the same. So how do you reinvent something with the same products? And while you're introducing some new items?
So I guess it would be depending based on the season or if there's a holiday that I can use the same merchandise. Like right now on our front table, we have the LESPA California Summer, which is their new set. And it's on the entire front table. There's poppies that coincide with the color packaging on the boxes. And then there are also books that coordinate the colors that also pop and create that entire vignette that you could buy a candle and pair it with a book, and it can be a gift or for yourself.
Speaking my love language. I just did that display up at Missoni this last week, and it took me, because I don't do the Voluspa display as Stephen Young. Lisa does it. So I didn't realize that those two new pattern boxes are the same pattern, but the square in the front is the only difference. So I had it all mixed together, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, this is two totally different fragrances. So I had a split. I used the California blue in between those two to separate them. And I wish so bad I had orange poppies, because that was the one thing with that packaging that was like, I can only imagine how beautiful it is. When you do display, where do you start? What's your starting point if you're starting with like nothing on the table?
So it all depends. I try to look for a hero piece that I can add as like a statement piece that technically I wouldn't say would be for sale, but if somebody was interested in purchasing it, by all means. But it's usually if I find something that I like or that will work, and then I kind of base the story off of that one focal piece. Like one of our front tables right now also has a beautiful vintage patina scale.
Hmm.
And I also on that same table have it paired with shortbread cookies and flavored honey. And then there's books on how to make cookies and all of that. So it's creating a full story.
I love the cross merchandising. I mean, I storytelling for retailers who are listening, merchandising is storytelling. And I, for the people that do it so well, you guys, like the storytelling aspect of it is so important. It's done through books and from merchandising and your architecture. I love the word hero, the hero piece. And that is all what creates these yummy stories that literally draw people in. And I always also say is that merchandising and your merchandiser is your silent salesperson, because when that's done and you step away and it's this beautiful mix, and people start coming in just from that, and then they start picking up one thing, and then they see the book, and it's that those add-on sales. It's like, it is magic. How many SKUs, because I go down this a lot, when you're doing a table, what is your capping point of where you go, oh shit, there's way too much on this table?
So I don't know if I stick with the true story of stack it high and watch it fly. But
I'm old school, to gallery.
But in that sense, like I will limit the quantities to add more SKUs, I guess. So this past, like for March, I created a round table that we have in the center of the shop. It has food on it. And within that tower of food, there's probably about 10, 12 different SKUs. And then there's also books and cutting boards and everything right on that one table. But the way it's merchandised, it's like easy on the eye. You can It tells a story you can easily see and walk around in. It speaks to whoever's standing in front of it.
I love it. Do you, what was one of the, I had a question in my head and now, of course, I forgot. This is what happens when you get old. You totally forget what the hell you're talking about. When it comes to holiday, you were in Glitterville when I saw you. What does your holiday look like? I know this is, everyone's like, fuck, really holiday already? But you buy in January. So what are your holiday concepts look like?
You want to take this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So pretty much, again, the front of the store gets redone and it's pretty much a winter wonderland. So like the street appeal, like if you've never been in the shop and you're in the parking lot, just looking at the store windows, it looks lit up as a snow globe from the outside. Mm-hmm. And when you walk in, you're kind of walking through like a magical wonderland of Christmasville.
And I think color scheme, we stick to more of a traditional gold, silver, white. We don't bring in any red. We try to stay away from kind of that kitschy. There's no buffalo check patterns and things like that. So it's just those colors. And then the rest of the store past the front entrance can be some of the more
vintage.
Yeah, traditional. Yeah.
You guys, what that just made me think about, because if you are keeping the walls all white for the cohesiveness, when it comes to the overall display as far as like holiday and whatnot, how do you have big elements that are what carry you through, that are the constant display throughout the store, which are kind of like the equalizer? Or is it the front is the big opening equalizer and then everybody kind of goes off and does their own thing?
I think for the most part, people do their own thing. The great thing is most of our dealers have been with the shop for the entire 36 years. So they know what the customers want. Like they are experts in their little booth. And so, we were blessed that we inherited those dealers when we took over. And so they do their own thing. And we do try to push to the other newer dealers that holiday is our biggest quarter. Fourth quarter equals the first three quarters combined for us. So, I mean, it's no joke that it's like, wow, you've got to have a successful fourth quarter or you're just going to be in pain for the rest of the year. And I think the dealers that have been with us for several years realize that. And so they pull out some really beautiful merchandising displays.
I mean, I will say like what I said earlier is when you go into a lot of these antique malls, it's like, it is sometimes it's extremely painful where there's a couple really good ones. And then it's like, the crappy glass cabinets that have, most of what you see are million tags versus the product, but your vendors are all like so good at what they do as far as merchandising, where it does come off as it's one store. When a new person comes in, and I've always wondered this, like, I don't think you have a lot of turnover. Am I right? As far as vendors?
Yeah. One of our most recent new dealers, he was on the waiting list for 12 years. That's generally how I frame things. It's like, it doesn't mean that it's going to be 12 years for every dealer, but we have very low attrition.
Impressive. So when somebody comes in new, is it like, I would guess it's like introducing anybody into a family or a tribe or a community. It's how do you have certain rules that like, here's our rules. Like these are our standards. These are our rules. Do you sit down and have a meeting? Do you have like, how do you explain this?
It's an application process. So that's generally how we'll frame it. That it's like, it's not a waiting list where you're next on the list. So you got the next spot that comes available. When a space comes available, we look at what the store needs. Do we need jewelry? Do we need gift items? Do we need furniture? And then we look at our pool of applicants and look for who we think would be the best. I think we've made it a little harder now to apply. And so we ask that if someone is interested, that they, with their application, submit a photo of showing their merchandising.
100%.
We don't want to just see a shelf with thrift store items placed next to each other. And then the last one is I want to see a holiday display, and it doesn't have to be a Christmas display. It just needs to be giftable, like something that kind of celebrates that season, because it's so important to us. And the more of that, the happier our customers will be.
Yeah, I think that's really important, again, because I think that your customers are so, it's like eye candy. You go in there and it's like everybody needs to be as strong as the others. And that, you know, that is the key to, you know, any store. It's like, you know, like every display needs to be as strong. I mean, every vendor needs to be as strong. So I love that you've made it harder to get in, which makes it more of a reason why it's like you really want to up your game if you're trying to get into one of these places. It's like, I mean, that for anybody that's, you know, in any type of this situation, it's like submit as many pictures as you can and show what you do and that you do it well.
Well, yeah, and definitely having social media presence, you know, we're looking. I always tell dealers, it's like, if you're new to the business, I want you to become my competitor one day. So it's like, that's kind of the premise. It's like, I want you to be successful so that you leave and open up a store right next to me. And we're all doing very well and doing our own things and having our own points of view. You know, some of the malls that we had been in the past micromanaged a lot, and we don't micromanage our dealers. We assume they know what they're doing. And so we've rarely had to go in and be like, we need you to change this or remove this item. Like that's a very rare circumstance. I think a dealer brought in a Playboy with Trump on it. And it's like, we let it stay. And we were like, this isn't really the vision of the store, but you know, it was in a glass case in the back. So, and like, we'll see. And sure enough, it sold within a week. So it's just like, yeah, okay.
I will never forget. And this is like, I mean, I either should or shouldn't be sharing the story. I went back to Atlanta back in the day. I did the Gans showroom. And this is like, I want to say 25 years ago. And I went with my good friend, Jessica, who grew up there. She's like, we had a ton of vintage props that we needed to buy. So she's like, we're going to rent a van and we're going to go through the hills of Georgia. And I did not realize like how collectible, well, in some areas, how collectible things like Third Reich, like books are, and Song of the South books are, and Confederate flags. And I being California and liberal, sorry, but you know, I went in and I'm standing there in front of a glass case. And I looked at Jess and I'm like, who's from there or if we grew up there? I'm like, I can't believe they have Song of the South books. And this good old boy gets up from the back and he's like, can I help you? And Jess is all, we gotta go. Let's go. She's like, don't say anything, Michelle. Don't. And I'm like, but I can't understand. And then there's Confederate. She's like, let's go. Let's go. And yeah, I can imagine how, like, some things in some areas where people bring in that are highly collectible, where it's like you have to sit there and go, does this work here? Does this not? But I find it hilarious. I mean, not hilarious, but I don't doubt that magazine sold right away.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a little bit of a surprise, but it wasn't highly visible. It's not like we put it in the front window. But yeah, like, I don't, it would take a lot for me to have to tell a dealer, like, you got to get rid of this. Yeah. Just because we've been in that situation where a mall owner has asked us to change something.
Really? What did they ask you to change?
I think it was, so we had a window at a mall, and we put a really big piece of furniture in it, and I think it blocked some of the light coming into the store.
I understand why.
Little things like that, where it's just like, we moved it. It was fine. But there's that part where you're just like, what? You don't like my piece of furniture?
You know? Well, it's like so much ego, and not to say ego, but so much as a merchandiser or a designer, so much is tied up to your personality, where, and also it's like, we all do what we do because it's like, don't you love, like, doesn't it look amazing? Like that's, I mean, customers coming in. I mean, that's truly why. So yeah, when I get like complaints or like, I don't love it. And it's like, oh, like this. Yeah. So I get that. I've had you guys for almost an hour. I have to ask, you guys are still sourcing. So how are you balancing sourcing and the merchandising and the running of the store and life?
Yeah. So I think life has kind of been on hold, which is fine because we've always had, like, our work has been our lives before this. So not big of too much of a change there. With sourcing, we definitely don't hit our hunting holes like we used to. So we tell some of our dealers, it's like, oh, if you're going down to this area or up to that area, check out this place because we used to find great pieces there. And I think most recently, we finally did some antiquing in Las Vegas while we're there.
Really? Where?
There's some really good antique stuff. So we went to maybe six different antique malls and bought something at every single mall. Like, rarely does that happen.
You'll have to tell me the information, because I never had a chance. I know that there's, in the arts district, there's some things, I think, but I never ventured out. So I'll have to get that information from you.
Yeah. And so that's nice, because we go to Vegas twice a year. We stay there for the whole week. We try to do all of our appointments before the show actually starts, because that's just, we like to have peace of mind and not be bumping into people and fighting for a rep to write our order. So it's like, we're already there. So then if we get all of our orders in and before the show starts, then that takes some pressure off, and then we can kind of venture out into town and check out what's at the antique malls. So that's been great. We can bring back a van load of treasure twice a year from Vegas.
I love it. Do you shop temps also?
Probably not as much now, because, I mean, that does get repetitive, even though that's so much of it, you know, appears that it's antique, but it's all mass produced in India and China. So there's already a lot of that in our area. So if we find something that's a good deal, we'll pick it up. But otherwise, we kind of let the vultures. I don't know if you've been there the morning that it opens, like, people line up out front.
Can't handle the stress.
And it's like, it's just like all of these people with their little carts and stuff racing to the back to, you know, get, like, just like a wooden bowl, like, that you can find anywhere.
Well, I mean, you know, and this is again, may or may not piss people off, but I mean, it's well known. There are a lot of people that don't have stores, e-commerce, brick. I mean, they are there just to buy stuff. A bunch of girlfriends that have a resale license to go buy stuff for their houses. And that's fine, but it is frustrating, because I know when I would go to the shows, and I forget what it was, but it was like, it was in temps, and I would actually write a couple lines in temps, and I would be there trying to fight for a rep's time who's writing, like, single item orders, you know, just so she can take it home for her friends. And it was like, I have to write an order for a store. Is that, and not to sound like I'm sounding so princessy, I almost right now want to take this out, but it is frustrating as a buyer to go and, like, compete with, like, because you are competing for a rep's time who's there and who just wants to please everybody, but you have appointments you have to make, you need places to go, and you're standing there waiting for, like, and I'll take one, and can you tell me, like, does this come in any other colors, and I'll take one, and, like, I need to write my order and get out. So that stress of that temporary situation, I don't go the first day anymore. I can't. It's like, it's too much.
You're just the alcohol. Like, I'm definitely someone that can enjoy a drink, but it's like, while I'm at the show, I don't need any alcohol. Like,
yeah. Well, if you've been to Atlanta, they start giving Bellinis out, like, at 9 a.m.
Yeah. I mean, that is great. If, like, that's like that Mad Men 1950s, I can drink all day and still do my job. But yeah, it's just like, I'm making major decisions for the holiday season. And so it's like, you know, I don't need to buy the wrong $10,000 worth of ornaments.
But yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna need my full brain power for this.
Yeah. You've heard stories on this about me doing ASR back in the day when we start doing shots at the Stussy booth and the Quicksilver booth at 9 a.m. and then me opening my box. It's like, what is this? And they're like, yeah, that was like about your fourth shot. That's why they do it. There's a reason behind it.
Well, I definitely appreciate. Oh yeah, go ahead.
My last question is, and I know you guys listen to it, so I know what's coming. Is, where do you guys find inspiration?
You want to take that first, or you want?
You can start.
So for me, so the right answer is, I find inspiration from within. Like, that's what I would say back in architecture and design and things like that. All of that inspiration is already inside of us. And so for me, on this second half of my career, I'm going back to these things that I did as a child, which is just really strange, you know, that I'm selling antiques now that I did when I was 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. So I think, like, that's what excites me, is I'm always looking back at things that I did in childhood that I'm now revisiting as an adult that has, you know, I have about 20 years left in the working world. And it's like, I want to have fun doing something. I don't want to be sitting at a desk, you know, climbing that corporate ladder. Like, that was not for me. And so I always tell people inspiration comes from within. Other than that, stimulation will come from definitely Instagram. And I think now that we do the gift shows so often, it's all there. Like you don't have to beat yourself up on not being able to merchandise correctly. It's like people like you, other rep lines, they have beautiful displays. And if that showroom lets you take photographs, which some of them say no photographs, I don't understand that, but it's like, take the photographs, save them, and then go back to them. I screenshot whenever, like Maison A, your front table with the bunny rabbits. I screenshot at that. It's like, I don't know when I'm going to need to reference that, but I may need to be like, what did Michelle do with that tall piece of architecture? How did she make that work with those stuffed animals or something like that? It's like, you got to build that bank, that body of knowledge that's already there. So it's like, just save it for the future and reference it as need be if you need some inspiration.
I always say take pictures. I mean, it is kind of ironic. Some showrooms, like one showroom, I forget where I was, but it was like literally like they're known for knocking people off and they have a giant sign that when you walk in the door, no photos. I'm like, that is so ironic. But I think most by far and large, if you ask people, can I take a picture? It's for my store and you have a store badge on. It's when you don't have a badge on and when you have a badge on that is from the building or another showroom that people get super dicey. Cause unfortunately for retailers that don't know, I'm sure you all do, but there's a large amount of vendors that go around. Their whole job is to knock each other off. And it's like, it's part of the business. It's, you know, it's like someone saying, I can get this on Amazon for less. It's like, it's part of the industry. It's just, you know, not to take it. But I've always like with photos, like, I used to ask all the time if I could take pictures. Now I think it's like, you know, now I realize that no one's around half the time and I can just take pictures. But if there are, like I always say, like take pictures, but it's always the best inspiration. And like to go back and look on your phone and like, especially if you wrote the line, I mean, that's like for merchandisers like myself that we do this for the retailers. It is always my hope that the retailer one comes to look at it and they are drawn into it because they love it so much. And then if they buy it, hopefully to try and emulate it in some way because they love the display so much. I mean, that is the biggest compliment that you just gave me. Thank you. Cause that's truly why as merchandisers, why we do this is that, you know, in hopes that somebody will A, buy it, but two, recreate it in their store.
To make it look successful because a lot of merchandise, those companies don't help you sell the product. So a lot of times when a merchandiser or a rep comes to us with a line, we will ask, it's like, what does the packaging look like? Do they have displays? Do they have signs? Like, we want these companies to help us out a little bit. And then from there, we'll take it. And if there is nothing, then yeah, you got to move on. You got to move on to a different product.
Nathan, where do you find inspiration? I want to hear this because I merchandiser, I know you find inspiration somewhere.
Yeah. So inspiration, of course, definitely comes with it. And then definitely having the background with like hairdressing is like a whole different like fashion and design and like idea or inspiration that comes with it. But definitely, like Spencer said, like the shows, like I would say that I definitely go to the shows to buy Christmas, but that's number one. And number two is definitely like critique floor sets and visual. Because it's like, would I have done that? Like, I did think of that. Maybe I'll take a picture and try to transform that or incorporate it into a floor set in the future that I do. And I guess it's mainly when you put a display together that I've done several times and you step away and it took you 4 hours to create and you're like, that's not working for me. And you clean that palette off again and you start over. And then you look at the clock and it's like 6 a.m. and you head out. And then the next day, staff opens up and customers come in and they're like, oh, the store looks great. That display is beautiful. And it's like, okay, the hard work sure paid off. And that inspiration with it definitely paid off and has been successful.
I have to ask this. Do you find that if you're standing there doing your merchandising for a long time and it's not coming to you, do you walk away from it and then come back to the next day and have that epiphany of like, well, it's not that bad, or like, okay, now I see why it's not working because you didn't see something at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever time you're merchandising at.
So there's been times that has happened that you get stumped and you don't know what to do or how to continue after a certain step. And sometimes I'll just try to piece it together as best as I can to make it presentable. And then the next day or the 2 days later, I'll go in and recreate based off of what I had already started. But I'll never leave a project left undone for the next day.
That's a good, I would love to say I don't, but I, unfortunately, there's days where it's like, you know, I can't stay any longer and I have to like tuck merchandise down underneath unit and make sure that there's walkway and that I do the opposite schedule. I go in at like 5 and 6 in the morning and I'll do it till 10. I can't stay up that late. Like the idea that you do, we have to stay up all night and we do all nighters for Bristol Farms. And even then I get a couple hours of sleep. I could not do the too many days, I think, or too many nights of me partying when I was like 18, 19, all nighters. Like I think it just like, I can't do that anymore.
We used to do the early mornings, but then we found we were still staying till midnight. And so then it was just like, that was not sustainable. But definitely on merchandising too, we always take a photo before when we're done with the night. And as we're going to bed, we look through the photos and things will come out in the photograph that it's just like, oh, that could be tweaked. Like that needs to change a little bit there. So like that'll be the next day of just doing some editing. Definitely, I do that with stuffed animals. Like, for some reason, I cannot make stuffed animals look good. They always just end up piling up into some pyramid. And it's like, this is awful. So that'll take a few days of editing before I get the stuffed animals right. And then they sell and then it gets start all over.
I find it hilarious that your pillow talk is looking at pictures of your displays. That is the last thing I want to do is look at pictures of my husband in bed and like, there'll be points where I'm like, I don't even want to talk about what we did today. Like, can we talk about something else? But I find that hilarious. It's your pillow talk.
Placing all of our orders reviewing photos of the store late at night. Like, that's our biggest thing. Ordering merchandise. It's like a REPL's be like, oh, can I come in and write a reorder for you? And it's like, I don't do that during the day. Like, that's a 11 o'clock at night kind of thing.
Got to give it to you guys. Well, obviously that dedication and the hours that you put into your business is there's a reason why that your business is what it is.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much for spending this time with me. I had so much fun talking to you. What I will ask is if you can send a couple pictures to us. We haven't posted pictures on the website, like where the episodes will show up. But I would like to be able to say, I'm going to find out, but if you can send me pictures of your opening statements and some of the things we talked about, and if we can put them on the pod page where, you know, the episode notes show up, I'm going to, because I know people would love to see the store. And next time I'm in town, because I come back to California the 19th of next month, and I know I'm doing Lit Concept for 3 days. So if I have a chance to get away, I'd love to come and visit you guys and see the store and do some film, because we do the Retail Whore road trip where we film. So I would love to do a little bit of filming in the store.
That's great. I love when you visited Nate and Company in San Francisco. Like that was great because, you know, all of these retailers have been through any struggles that we'll ever go through. So it's like hearing those war stories. It's like you can learn so much from people that have been in the business. And, you know, once those people are gone, like they take all of that knowledge with them unless they've written a book.
That's a lot of why this podcast, why I think so many people will stop and say, thank you so much. We're learning so much, because in retail in general, people do not like it. For some reason, it's very secretive. No one wants to give away their secrets, and because it's so competitive. But honestly, as an industry, all these specialty retailers, it's important that we all work together and we share ideas and what has worked and what hasn't. And because honestly, like I truly believe, like if you are the only one on your block, you're not a destination. If you have a block of other strong retailers and you all work together and you do events together, it makes a stronger experience for the customer and it makes you a destination. And I think you guys are doing that just within your own little community, but certainly with Wizen's marketing center. I mean, it's like, that is a community. I mean, it's, you know, it's a beautiful place to shop. And it's like, you go there as a destination and you have lunch and you go and you shop and it's like, it's fantastic, but your space is beautiful. So thank you so much for spending this time with me, because I'm so excited for people to hear this.
Yeah. Thank you again.
And that is a wrap. The Retailer Podcast is produced by myself, Michelle Sherrier, and Catherine Kalu. Our website, where you can find all of our episodes, can be found at www.theretailwhorepodcast.com. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, @3TillHorrorPodcast.